This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The issues of gun control and gun freedom tap into deeply held beliefs that often transcend party affiliation. A diehard Democrat like John Dingell is an active leader of the National Rifle Association. James Brady, the former aide to President Ronald Reagan, and his wife Sarah are prominent gun control advocates. Lines are being redrawn right now on Capitol Hill as Congress faces two key questions. Should the assault weapons ban passed in 1994 be extended? And should gun manufacturers be granted limited liability from lawsuits? Two Senate Democrats say President Bush needs to do more to deliver on his campaign pledge to renew the assault weapons ban, but Republican Tom DeLay, the majority leader in the House of Representatives, says the measure does not have the votes to pass and may not come to a vote. The limited liability bill would protect gun manufacturers from the kinds of lawsuits that were filed against cigarette makers. Later this hour, we'll talk with former baseball great Paul O'Neill about his life in right field at Yankee Stadium and about the book he's written about the influence that his father had on his career. But first, the politics of guns. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by two of the principal lobbyists for and against. If you have questions about either bill, about the politics of the issues, or about how both sides go about the business of lining up support, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Right now, we're joined in Studio 3A by NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. And always good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here, Neil.
What is the assault weapons ban and where does it stand in Washington Congress right now?
The assault weapons ban, as you said a moment ago, was passed back in 1994 when the Democrats were still in control on Capitol Hill. And some of the people in the Senate, mostly Democrats, but some Republicans as well, would like to extend that ban when it expires in 2004. They'd like to make it permanent. And while you might not think that this was the sort of thing they'd have a lot of expectation of passing in the current Congress, they do have one reason for confidence, and that is President Bush, when he was running for president, said he didn't have any problem with that assault weapons ban being extended and has recently reasserted that support for an extension of the ban, so long as it doesn't get any tougher. Mm-hmm. Of course, they would like to add some toughening amendments to it, but there are a number of people in the Senate who have made it clear they don't want to see that particular piece of legislation passed in the Senate. And then, of course, yesterday we heard Tom DeLay in the House saying he was not interested in even having it come to a vote. Now, just today, the Speaker of the House, who is still the boss, Dennis Hastert, said that he had not had a discussion with the president yet, that the leadership in the House as a whole had not discussed it, and so he was not yet willing to say one way or another whether the House would take it up and which way it would go.
Mm-hmm. So that one is still open.
Very much so.
Now, the bill in the Senate on the limited liability, that looks closer to passage.
Yes, the House has already passed it overwhelmingly. They have many Democratic votes for it, as well as, of course, an overwhelming Republican vote for it. And in the Senate, it has 52 co-sponsors. Now, that's a majority of the Senate. Sometimes the Senate actually does go by its majority, but in this case, a filibuster could necessitate 60 votes to make that ban on lawsuits against the gun manufacturing industry law. President has said he would sign it, but at least one senator has indicated she might be willing to filibuster that bill, and that's Barbara Boxer of California.
Now, Democrats, a lot of them in the House, are certainly supported this piece of legislation. Democrats turn their back on gun control?
Well, this isn't quite the same thing as gun control. In this particular instance, you're talking about the liability of people who manufacture guns for what might be done with those guns, whether or not they could be sued by the victims of gun violence or by cities that have a lot of costs associated with gun violence. One particular suit that's in the courts and has come to a recent decision involved the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, which felt its community had had a particular suffering because of guns, not just because they exist, but because the way they're manufactured and then marketed makes it too easy for people to get them who want to use them for ill purposes.
One thing that has changed, I guess, since the assault weapons ban first passed, though, is the perception of how the gun issue plays out in electoral politics in the last two elections.
Well, it does not seem to have done the Democrats much good. Al Gore, for example, in 2000, was seen to have lost West Virginia on two or three issues, but among them, maybe paramount among them, gun control. Had Al Gore, of course, won West Virginia, typically a Democratic state in presidential elections, he would be president today.
We're talking about Second Amendment issues. Ron, I can't let you go without discussing the recent prominence of the 25th Amendment, at least on television. There are two shows where this has come up, both 24 on Fox TV and NBC's The West Wing. They both invoke the 25th Amendment, the West Wing just last night. First of all, what is it and how is it used?
Well, this amendment was passed back in the 60s when people were worried about what would happen if the president were wounded. For example, as JFK had been in 1963, fatally wounded. What would you do if the president were incapacitated, but you weren't quite sure he was not going to be able to return at some point? So they passed this amendment, which sets up a procedure whereby if the president is in some sense incapacitated, then the vice president and a majority of the principal officers of the executive branch, we have generally assumed this to mean the cabinet, would then vote and decide whether or not they thought the vice president should take over the president's duties, and then that would be fait accompli unless, within 4 days, the Congress were to act to overturn it. Now, this is something I think we can all agree no one is eager to see happen. It would be a situation in which the president's capacity to continue as president were in question. Not to say he was dead, of course, but or even that he was in a coma or something obviously dispositive like that, but a president who, for one reason or another, was unclear in his ability to continue.
Well, what happened last night is the president's daughter's been kidnapped. They're afraid they could extort some concession out of him. And so if that were the case and they go in and collect the president's daughter and everything's okay, how do you undo it once you've already appointed the Speaker of the House, in this case John Goodman, as President of the United States?
Well, if all of these things could be, in a sort of episodic, fictional sense, straightened out, there is the power in the House and the Senate to take a vote and restore the president to his full powers, assuming that the president wants them back and petitions for them himself, and they can get the two-thirds vote to overturn this action by the executive branch. As I said, pretty far-fetched stuff, nothing that has ever happened or has ever been contemplated or seemed likely to happen, and something I think we can all hope remains in the realm of fiction.
And just in this case, Aaron Sorkin digging whoever replaces him as the writer on that show into a deep hole at the start of next season. Ron Elving, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Neil.
Let's get back to the issue at hand, and that is the politics of guns as it emerges on Capitol Hill this week. Joining us now by phone from Capitol Hill is Chris Cox, Executive Director of the National Rifle Association's Institute for Legislative Action. Good of you to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
The assault weapons ban, why do you think at this point it should not be extended?
Well, it shouldn't be extended because it shouldn't have passed in the first place. It's shown in all studies that have been done to be ineffective. All the claims about crime going down were wrong, and it clearly was a sham and a bogus law 9 years ago and should be allowed to sunset. I think it's important to note that these same reasons of the ban being ineffective is why Congress, less than 2 years after it was passed, at least the House of Representatives voted to repeal it.
Well, one of the reasons its proponents say it might have been judged ineffective is that there are a lot of loopholes. Another way of making it more effective would be to close the loopholes.
Well, these are the same folks who want to ban all guns. You know, the McCarthy's bill that's been introduced in Congress would add millions of more guns to the gun ban. Let's be clear here. The American public needs to know that this is not about machine guns. The other side would like to confuse people and confuse Congress into thinking that this is about machine guns. It's not. This is about Dianne Feinstein going on 60 Minutes and saying that if she could ban all guns and pick them up out of every household, she would do it. That's a step in that direction.
Now, one of those issues that might confuse people is the support of the President of the United States for this extension.
Right. The real theater of action here is going to be in Congress. The administration took a position during the campaign, and we disagree with it. The administration's also brought up serious questions with regards to whether or not this law has been effective. And as I said, every study that's come out, including studies from the Clinton Justice Department, has shown that it's had no effect. So the questions are going to be answered by Congress, and we're going to work to arm Congress with the facts so they can let this let this law expire.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking at the moment with Chris Cox of the National Rifle Association. In a few minutes, Mike Barnes of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence will join us. But let's get some listeners involved. And Susie joins us on the line from Pocosin, Virginia. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
No, it's Pocosin, Virginia.
Okay, well, go ahead, please.
I'd just like to point out to Mr. Cox the reason that the Senate, the House voted to repeal that law was because of the House change in 94. That's why that came to the vote again. And how can he and the NRA believe that it's a good thing people should be able to put their hands on automatic, large-capacity machine or handgun or rifles?
Susie, I think to be fair, he's not talking about automatic weapons. These are the weapons that are in this bill are you know, machine guns are illegal, and I don't think the NRA says they should.
But the large capacity clip is what's covered under the assault weapon. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, Chris
Cox? And there are, you know, you can hear all kinds of arguments about, well, it's going to ban, or this particular bill, the assault weapons ban, bans hunting rifles, and it does not ban hunting rifles. There are specifically several hundred excluded from this bill.
Mm-hmm.
The things that are currently banned under the assault weapons ban are large capacity clips, you know, guns that have grenade launchers on them, have scope capability, have...
Susie, let's give Chris Cox a chance to respond.
Okay? Sure, I'd like to make a couple of comments. First, you're absolutely right. We're not talking about fully automatic weapons, and to suggest that is not doing is doing a disservice to the listeners today. With regards to the reason why the House voted to repeal that part of the legislation less than 2 years after it passed, had to do with a couple things. One was that the study that was mandated by Congress came out and showed that this law had no effect on reducing crime. You know, she talked about a new Congress. The reason there was a new Congress was the American people saw through this and voted a lot of those folks who, those members of Congress, out of office. And they've continued to get much more serious on this issue. With regards to the issue of gun ownership and hunting, I'm a hunter myself, but the Second Amendment has really nothing to do with hunting. The Second Amendment is about self-defense. And the truth of the matter is 99% of people who own guns never do anything wrong with them. And it's wrong to punish them just because of the acts of a very small number of criminals. The focus should be on criminal misuse of guns, not on law-abiding gun owners.
It's not about the Second Amendment. That was not even part of the scope of this. It's about what purpose does the average Joe citizen have to have the capability of owning a weapon like a Bushmaster that was used in the sniper shootings.
And was not covered under the assault weapons ban.
Yeah.
Right, and the guns that she's talking about is the legislation that's been reintroduced in the House. A number of those guns that were specifically protected have now been added and would be covered by the new legislation. But it goes back to the point that these guns are rarely used in crime. They're the people who own them for lawful reasons. Of course, we should focus. Nobody wants a gun in the hand of a criminal. Nobody wants that more than law-abiding gun owners, because, you know, folks like the next person who's going to be on your show would like to blame law-abiding gun owners for the, you know, misuse of guns by criminals. That's not the case. The majority of people who own guns, the overwhelming majority, are law-abiding people. They own them for self-defense. They own them to hunt. They own them to collect, and they're absolutely no threat to anyone. But to suggest that these are fully automatic weapons, or that these are, you know, or something that they're not, is really doing a disservice to the listeners.
Oh, Susie, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking about whether gun victims should have the right to sue gun makers, and also should the ban on assault weapons be extended by the Congress. Tough questions. We'd like to hear yours. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email at totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after a short break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later on in the hour, we'll talk with retired baseball great Paul O'Neill about his new book, Me and My Dad, a baseball memoir. Right now, though, we're talking about gun control and gun freedom. Our guest right now is Chris Cox, executive director of the National Rifle Association's lobbying arm, and he's with us on the phone from Capitol Hill. And Mr. Cox, you're on Capitol Hill. That's, of course, where their lobbyists do their work. We have this image of lobbyists, you know, I guess. We don't know how you go about do your job. What do you do to line up support for a bill like this?
Well, we listen to NRA members all over the country. You know, the real power in the National Rifle Association's and 4 million people who pay their dues and pay their taxes and own guns legally and lawfully. And when we speak with one very loud voice. You know, we work with members of Congress and, you know, all the way down to the city council level on issues that protect, on issues dealing with the Second Amendment. We work with elected officials all over the country every day to make sure the voices of gun owners and law-abiding citizens are heard.
When you say you work with them, what does that mean? Do you go into their offices and talk to them? What does it mean?
Sure. We educate. We do our best to educate elected officials on what's usually the other side of the story. You know, what you see on national TV and here on the radio is not always accurate, and it's our job to make sure that we arm politicians with the true facts. So often this issue is argued on emotion and not on fact, and we're there to supply the facts.
What of your opponent's arguments? What's the most effective argument against? I'm going to ask Mr. Barnes later, too. But, you know, when you hear your opponents come up with an argument, which is the hardest one for you to combat?
Well, the hardest ones to combat are the ones that are based on flat-out lies or on emotion, and they're very adept at both. You know, when the caller earlier mentioned, you know, fully automatic machine guns, Josh Sugarman from the Radical Violence Policy Control Group, who's an anti-gun group, has made that comment, and a quote, that the public's confusion over fully automatic machine guns versus semi-automatic weapons can only increase the chance of public support. And when you go on national news and they lead into a story on semi-automatics showing fully automatic weapons, it really does a disservice to the viewers, to the listeners, and that's what we fight against the national news media that unfortunately all too often buys their argument hook, line, and sinker.
We have an email question from John Miller in Milwaukee. Could you ask your guest how this issue is affected by the threat of terrorists arming themselves?
Well, I guess, Pat, in the post 9/11 days, a lot of folks started buying guns, and we were asked, you know, why would people, you know, want to buy guns after what happened, you know, on that dreadful day? And I guess the answer is, you know, it's your most basic instinct is to protect yourself. And people since 9/11 have gotten much more serious about their freedoms, including their Second Amendment freedoms, and they've really called on their elected officials to do the same.
I hear your point, but that's not the question that was asked. The question was worry that terrorists could come here on a flight and then, purchase weapons that they could use in a terrorist act here. That's the way I understood it anyway.
Okay, well, obviously there's federal, state, and local laws that would prohibit any type of terrorist from purchasing a firearm, certainly a foreign terrorist. There's laws in place and certainly laws that are enforced by our law enforcement officers to make sure that the people who aren't law-abiding Americans are to keep guns out of their hands. Obviously, it's a concern, and the National Rifle Association and our members all over this country will do their part to help make the country safe.
One more question for you, sir, and then we'll get to Mike Barnes from the other side. Martha joins us from Tallahassee, Florida.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I just wanted to hear the gentleman's views on what I see as a confliction of rank and file NRA and the gun manufacturers, because as soon as the assault weapon ban went into effect, it prohibited the manufacturing of these certain types of guns, but not owning them or selling them used and in the gun show circuit. And so people who own these guns saw their value double and triple. And if the assault weapons ban would sunset, then it seems to me that the value of those guns would decrease. And so I'm curious is whether the NRA is having rank and file members on the one hand not really wanting to see the sunset, but the manufacturers on the other hand wanting the sunset.
That's a really interesting point. I guess NRA members and gun owners all over this country are more concerned with their freedoms and their right to own a gun than any increase in value over those guns. While certainly welcome, I'm sure, most law-abiding gun owners want their rights protected more so than they want an increase in the value of their firearms.
Well, we're going to leave it there with you, Chris Cox. Excuse me, I have an old friend named Chris Koch, and that's why I'm making the mistakes, but I apologize for that. Chris Cox, thank you very much for being with us, and Martha, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, Chris Cox is Executive Director of the National Rifle Association's Institute for Legislative Action, and he was with us on the phone from Capitol Hill. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Mike Barnes, President of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, united with the Million Mom March, and good of you to be with us.
Thank you, Neil. Happy to be able to join you.
And appreciate your patience as well. Now, you've heard Chris Cox of the NRA make his arguments about the two issues on the table. What's your response?
Well, first of all, on what these weapons are, I served in the United States Marine Corps, and I fired these high-powered weapons, and there is no legitimate civilian use for the kind of Bushmaster weapon that was used by the shooters that terrorized this region of the United States last fall. Hunters don't need these semi-automatic high-powered assault weapons to hunt unless they are very bad hunters indeed, and no one needs these for self-defense. It's true that they're not fully automatic, but a semi-automatic weapon is one that you just, as fast as you can pull your finger, that gun's going to shoot. And a lot of tragedies, incredible tragedies, have happened here in the United States because of easy access to these weapons. The caller that asked about, or the email that asked about terrorists having easy access to weapons, anybody can buy these guns. And in many states in this country, you can buy as many as you want. You can walk into a store in many states in the United States and buy hundreds of these kinds of weapons. And it's crazy. No other civilized country in the world allows the easy access to weapons that we do in America. And at a time when we know that there are terrorists among us, we keep being told by the FBI and others that there are terrorists in the United States intent on doing damage to us. And what we saw last fall with one weapon could do in the hands of those two alleged snipers here in the Washington area, we know the threat from these weapons. So our nation needs to tighten our laws. Clearly, we need to renew the assault weapons ban. It ought to, in fact, be strengthened. And we are urging President Bush, who says he wants to renew the law, to push for renewal and to push for tightening the law. He's got to pick up the phone and call Tom DeLay, and his buddy from Texas, and say, Tom, I saw that you say you don't want to even have a vote in the Congress on whether to renew the assault weapons ban. That's a serious mistake. This is a matter of public safety. The other issue, the liability for the gun industry. This would be, Neil, the only industry in America that you couldn't sue for simple negligence. And we talked about the sniper case. The gun dealer out in Tacoma, Washington, that somehow the snipers got the gun from. Mm-hmm. The gun dealer says, I don't know how it left my store. He says there's 238 high-powered weapons that he can't account for. He never declared them missing, never declared them stolen. But one of those weapons was used to kill 11 of our neighbors here in the Washington area. That dealer was clearly negligent. And the families of those victims who were killed are suing that gun dealer. Not about money. It's about changing the way these people do business.
My understanding of the bill, it was to protect gun manufacturers, not
it's
gun dealers.
It's dealers, distributors, manufacturers. It's anybody who's engaged in the firearms industry. It's crazy. There's a gun dealer in West Virginia who sold 12 semi-automatic handguns to somebody. Now, that dealer knew that that wasn't a hunter coming in to buy 12 semi-automatic handguns. He knew that wasn't somebody who wanted to protect his family. He knew that was a gun trafficker. Well, that gun trafficker took those guns back to New Jersey. One of those guns was purchased and then shot two police officers. Those two police officers, thank God they're still alive, are suing the gun dealer in West Virginia, saying this is irresponsible conduct to sell 12 semi-automatic handguns to somebody from New Jersey. This is about trying to make the industry be more responsible. It's not like the tobacco thing where there was billions and billions and billions of dollars involved. This is about trying to get an industry to change the way it does business. Perhaps you saw the 60 Minutes thing Sunday evening when an insider from the gun industry, a former leader of the gun lobby, spoke with Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes and talked about how the gun industry knows that the way it does business pushes thousands every year, hundreds of thousands of weapons into criminals' hands in the United States. This is outrageous. It ought to be stopped. And that's what it's about. The immunity legislation would make the gun industry the only industry in America that you couldn't sue. If you want more information about it, go to our website, bradycampaign.org or millionmonmarch.org, and you can get more information about all these issues.
Let's get some listeners involved. Gus joins us on the line from Miami.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
And I truly respect and the Brady organization is certainly a credible organization fighting for their cause. I, however, come from Cuba in a country where the first thing the government did was take the arms away from their people, and thus leaves a rather sour taste in the mouth when laws are being are focused on restricting gun ownership in one level or another. When it comes to the actual liability issue more directly, manufacturers, I mean, when it comes to an issue of the product not working properly, definitely should be sued. So if a gun misfires and hurts someone, absolutely. But the use of a gun or any type of arm, whether it be a vehicle that can be used as a tool to hurt someone as a gun, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, I think it's blaming back the small little business owner that makes very little profit from whatever he sells and is probably a hobbyist to carry a lot of responsibility that they shouldn't be burdened with, unless the federal government's going to help them with resources to be able to qualify people and to be able to educate others and to help their inventory. They don't have the money to do that. I don't know where we get the money from.
Mike Barnes?
Well, you make a very good point. If that dealer hasn't done anything wrong, he shouldn't be sued. But it's like any other small business or any other business. If they haven't done anything wrong, they shouldn't be sued. And if they are sued, if it's a frivolous suit, the judge will throw it out. The issue is in cases where it's not frivolous, where they've done something wrong, and where victims ought to at least have their day in court to argue that they've done something wrong, like the sniper victims or like the police officers that I described.
Gus, go ahead.
Yeah, a small company, it's really nice to say, well, it's a frivolous suit, it'll get to court, and it'll be dismissed by a judge. That takes a long time. Small businesses can't afford even a lawyer to be able to do this. They're just basically, a lot of them are just getting by. So, I mean, unless you're going to return, when there's a frivolous suit, you're going to return payment to the small company for all the license, you know, the loss and effort, I think maybe. But if you're just going to wait till the court system throws out a frivolous suit just because either a government agency came in and did an operation or because someone says that they did something wrong, I'm not a gun owner and I'm not a gun store owner, but I think it's wrong to put that weight on a small business.
Well, it's on every other industry in America. So if you maybe your point is a good one, but it shouldn't just apply to one industry. You could think of other industries that it might make some sense to say you can't sue them if they're negligent, but an industry that makes and markets a lethal weapon, that's the industry we're going to single out for this kind of immunity. It's bizarre. And on your first point, I've been to Cuba, and you're right. It's an incredible tragedy to see what's happening in that country with the dictatorship. But if arming the citizens meant that you were going to be, you know, a safe and comfortable environment in which to live, then Iraq would be, you know, one of the safest places in the world right now, because it looks like everybody over there is carrying assault weapons. And the same would be true in Afghanistan. The tragedy here is that 30,000 Americans are dying every year with gun violence. And our Congress is saying the answer is not to do more to stop it. The answer is to give immunity to the industry that makes the product that contributes to this tragedy.
Gus, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller. Joe joins us on the line from Boston.
Yes, I want to say that I am, firstly, I am a Democrat. I am not a gun owner, but I resent the deliberate distortions of fact that Mr. Barnes consistently is presenting on these issues. You say that a, quote, assault weapon has no use in the art of hunting. You're quite wrong. What you are choosing to call an assault weapon is nothing more than the single-fire, single-trigger-pull weapon that John Browning invented in 1897 and has been the legal right of every American, every qualified citizen, to own since 1905. And you're also quite incorrect to say that the gun fires as fast as you can pull your trigger. It doesn't. You have to wait a bit between reloads. This is well known. An assault weapon, as you call it, is not an assault weapon. You've just used the term assault weapon to characterize the guns used by people in Iraq. Those are machine guns. And you are deliberately confusing the issue. There's no question about that.
Joe, to be fair, I think on the other side, the AK-47 is a select fire weapon, and to use it as a machine gun would burn the barrel up pretty quickly. But anyway, Mr. Barnes, go ahead.
Well, I think the gentleman makes my point very well, that these are rapid-fire, high-powered weapons. There is no legitimate civilian use for these kinds of weapons. I have fired them. And if anybody listening to this believes that these are the kinds of weapons that you want in your neighborhood, go to a rifle range and fire one of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And you will see that there, you know, this is, I carried this kind of weapon in the Marine Corps. It was an M16. Now, that was fully automatic. But the AR-15 is a knockoff of the weapon that I carried. It's banned under the assault weapons ban. The Bushmaster is a knockoff of the AR-15. The federal government ought to be enforcing this law more strictly, and these other weapons should not be available. And this gentleman also talked about freedom. And Mr. Cox from the NRA said Second Amendment, I guess, at least 15 times.
Mm-hmm.
This is really a bogus issue. The issue is what is sensible. If we have a Second Amendment, if we have a constitutional right, if I have a constitutional right to bear arms, in the 1700s that meant, you know, a bow and arrow or maybe a musket. Today, arms include rocket-propelled, tanks.
And those are illegal, and I don't think anybody's arguing that they should be legal.
But where do you draw the line? They say assault weapons should be legal. We argue they shouldn't. And 90% of the American people in the last poll that I saw believe that they should not be legal.
And if that's the case, why are so many in Congress opposed to your position? Why are so many going to vote against it?
A very simple response, Neil, is they are gutless when it comes to standing up to the power of the gun lobby. I served for 8 years, as you know, in the United States Congress.
Democrat from Maryland.
And I saw the power of the gun lobby, the intimidation, the tens of millions of dollars that they spend every 2 years to run TV ads, often that don't even mention guns, to defeat politicians that are on the other side of this issue. And it's interesting, in polling that's done, take the assault weapons issue, not only do 90% of the American people support an assault weapons ban, and a real one, a tough one, a tight one that would ban all semi-automatic weapons like this, 80% of gun owners support it. A majority of NRA members support it. But the leadership of the NRA, as Bob Ricker, a former employee, former lawyer for the NRA, said, has become a bunch of, this is a quote from him in the New York Times, a bunch of right-wing wackos that have taken over the NRA and believe we all ought to be walking around with Uzis.
Mike Barnes, thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Mike Barnes, president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, united with the Million Mom March. When we come back, we'll leave the Alabaster Capitol for the Green Cathedral of the Baseball Diamond. Yankee legend Paul O'Neill will join us. He's just written a book, Me and My Dad. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.